think that all of us have these very deep feelings of tenderness.
You get stronger as you become more open.
If I can be vulnerable, that'll help other people be vulnerable.
And it doesn't work for me to be silent.
I can't believe I'm going to tell you this story, but I'm going to tell you this story.
This is the first time that I've told aloud.
If I could have known that you and I were alike, I would have had so much more hope.
Listening to other people's stories, you realize,
wow, these people are all experiencing the same thing that we are.
You are not the only one.
Welcome to Safe Space Radio's healthcare education podcast on death and dying. At the end of this show, please go back to our website to answer a few questions that will help reinforce some of the important clinical takeaways. Your feedback will also help us learn more about the value of hearing our patients as teachers. Talking directly about death and dying is often avoided in our society, addressed only out of necessity as individuals face terminal illness. In this show, we'll hear from four guests about the power of talking openly about death, and also the risks of keeping silent. We start by hearing from Bobby Paysant, an inmate at the Maine State Prison. Bobby is part of a program that has been training prisoners to become hospice volunteers for men dying alone in the prison infirmary. We discuss Bobby's work as a hospice volunteer, giving care to inmates dying in prison. In this interview, Bobby shares his insights about the power of presence and open-hearted caregiving at the end of life, including a discussion of the concepts of validation therapy, which is an approach that embraces and joins individuals in their own reality at the end of life, rather than correcting them. Here's my conversation with Bobby. So I'd like to start by inviting you to tell me a little bit about how you got involved with hospice. How did you hear about it? What made you want to do this?
Okay. Well, being in prison and having been here for quite a while, one of the unfortunate things about that is you see people come to the end of their lifespan. For me, a personal friend of mine spent his last days up in the infirmary here at the prison under hospice care. He died of cancer. His name was Frank. And I remember going to visit him in his last days. Actually, I was blessed enough to be able to spend his last night with him before he lost consciousness for the last time. Being able to see the hospice workers in action and the way that they just really cared for Frank in every aspect and did everything in their power to make him feel comfortable, it really touched my heart, and I immediately felt like it was something I could do. Even though I wasn't a volunteer at that time, Frank being my friend, I'd help him out. I'd put lotion on his legs and on his hands. I'd give him water to drink to help keep him hydrated. I'd help feed him. I'd sneak in special foods for him that he particularly liked. So it was something that I felt like I could do and wanted to do. And then I eventually, when the opportunity presented itself, signed up to be considered. And luckily, I was chosen.
I want to come back to your friend Frank and what you saw that night.
Okay.
Had you ever seen someone die before that?
No, luckily, no.
What was it that you saw that really touched you, that really made you want to be part of that?
Just the patience and the attentiveness to his needs. And God bless him, he is a stubborn man, a Vietnam vet. And if he didn't like you, he didn't like you, and he didn't mix words about it. Mm. And so, to see how the hospice workers were able to come from a position where Frank wasn't sure what he felt about them to work with him and to gain his trust, and in the end, he really wanted them there, and just the way they treated him. I mean, you knew it was all the feelings that were involved and everything that they did, their actions, it was all authentic.
So you knew Frank, and you knew that he wouldn't put up with anything that wasn't authentic, basically.
Exactly. I mean, there were hospice workers that he said, yeah, that guy there is not going to be sitting with me, not working with me. Which in hospice, what we do is we celebrate that right of the client, for lack of a better word, to have that ability to dictate who works with them. Because in the end, it's all about their comfort, not anyone else's. We try to take care of them as best as possible on a physical level, but also on a on an emotional and mental level too. We work with them, and we try to take them out of the infirmary. Some guys can come out, some guys can't. But we do everything we can. We exercise up there. We walk the halls. We'll play cards. Some of us will bring our musical instruments and do soft music with guitar.
It sounds like you do a real hybrid between almost direct personal care and some of the more, what I think of as sort of more traditional hospice work, like really listening and being
right.
present. And I know one of the traditional services that hospice offers is like a life review, enabling people to really reflect on their life. Do you do that with the people that are dying?
Yes. What we try to do is we try to let them lead and we follow. But when they give us the openings, we try to take advantage of them and to encourage them to share about memories, about their fears, and about the things that make them feel good. You know, we don't try to run from anything with our clients. We don't feel that's productive or beneficial to them. And I think there's a connectedness between pain and healing. I don't believe, and this is my personal thought, that you heal by ignoring pain.
As a psychiatrist, I couldn't agree with you more.
Oh, I'm glad somebody agrees with me on something.
That's right. In fact, what you said to me as we were just chatting before this interview is, don't try to avoid the pain of my story. Like, this is a redemption story, and I want to talk about the painful part of it.
Absolutely.
I have great respect for that.
Thank you.
I know in my own training, what I was told was, you can't really help someone go there unless you go there yourself. And so we were encouraged to really face our own demons and work through our own issues. Has that been part of your training, to look at the places of things that you might run from inside yourself so that you can help other people not do that?
Oh, absolutely. What we call is being present and understanding what being present really means. It means not just being there as a witness to what someone else is going through, but you're assisting them on that journey. You're walking the journey with them.
So do you have an example of that? Like, I don't know if you can tell me a story, keeping the identities private, but okay, of what it would mean to really be present with someone in something like that.
Okay. I'll tell you a story about, he shares it with everyone. One of my fellow workers, volunteers in here, Steve Carpentier. One of the people that he was working with hospice, right, was suffering from dementia. And what happened is that the person thought they were drowning. And they vocalized that. They said, I'm drowning. And Steve, you know, the easy thing for a lot of people, because they don't get it, is, no, you're not drowning, you're all right. And so many people, that's the way they communicate. They want everything quick, you know, and they want to tell people, you know, what they are or are not experiencing. And what Steve did, which is very, well, it's not classic, that's for sure, but it's representative of what we want to do, is he cradled the man. And he said, I got you. He says, you're not going to drown. I got you. I'm not going to let go. And what we've taught each other through classes and stuff is, when people are going through those things, our job is not to tell them anything about their situation and tell them that their pain isn't real, to tell them their experience isn't real. Our job is to be present, is to go there with them. And then when you go there with them, then you might be able to tease them out of that.
How did the man respond to it?
He looked up at him and he smiled. and he was quiet.
That's a beautiful story. I think maybe we all want something like that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. To feel like you can trust somebody, that they have your needs, your interest, you know, in their soul. You know, not to try to correct you or anything, just to be there and to support you and to love you.
Our next interview was originally included in a series about hidden emotions, with a focus on guilt. Guilt is all too frequently tied to death and dying, whether it's experienced by an individual looking back on their own life, or by family members after a loved one's death. Ted, our next guest, describes the events leading up to the death of his father. His story illustrates what can happen when you don't tell your story, and therefore don't get the benefit of a compassionate perspective that helps you see it differently. Here's Ted.
Hi, I'm Ted from Ontario, Ted Jr. The story about my dad, I guess it would start, I was working in a flower shop in my hometown. I'd moved back home. I'd been living with my parents for a year and a half in my mid-20s. My father always had a big resentment against me because I had dropped out of university, but then discovered that I had had a dyslexia, and so it was very hard for me to go to university. When he found that out, he was kind of, his attitude changed drastically towards me, and it was very visible. You know, he was very outgoing, talking to me, how's it going, always willing to converse suddenly. Once that kind of stigma had been removed from our relationship, where it wasn't my fault, I applied myself, it's just political science and law, too much reading. And when you're dyslexic and you don't know it, reading is the last thing you want to ever do. So I had been living at home, and I hadn't lived there since I was a teenager. So I'd moved out very young. So it was new living back with my parents, but we were enjoying it. And I had a job working at a flower shop with great people, and I loved my job. One morning I got a phone call. It was maybe about 10 in the morning. And they said, you know, your father's been taken to the hospital. Quickly, you're supposed to go down there. And it was the winter time, and I was wearing high snow boots, dirty jeans, just work clothing. And the thought of my arrogance was, I don't want to be seen down in a hospital with a lot of pretty nurses looking like a bum. And that's what I thought at the time. And I was like, okay, I'm going to whip home, have a shower, and then I'll drive straight down to the hospital. And that's what I did. You know, I can always justify it in saying that my dad was always particular that you should look nice. You know, as a little kid, I was never allowed to wear jeans to school, and I looked like a nerd. I had brown cords my whole life. So, you know, my father's very particular on how you looked in public, especially if I was going down to be seen by him. So I changed. I went home and changed. When I arrived at the hospital, I arrived to the elevator doors opening and seeing my father surrounded by doctors being pushed into an elevator with my dad's arms and legs frailing in the air, and he looked terrified. It was the first time that my dad looked terrified. And the doors closed, and I looked, and my brothers and sisters who lived in the city at the time as well had all been sitting around with him for the last half hour talking with him. And that was that half hour. I went home to shower. We all waited for the surgery to be over. He was rushed into, and about 12 hours later, he came out, and we were told that we could go home. And we went home at midnight and were told that, you know, if he makes it through the night, he should be okay, hopefully. And so we all went home kind of lighthearted, and I called a friend and said, hey, you know, it's looking good, da-da-da, little weight. Let's have a couple drinks, da-da-da. At 3 a.m., we got a phone call, and my mom had stayed down there, of course, but the kids got a phone call and said, you have to come down and say goodbye. And my dad obviously never recovered from the surgery and was on life support. And so we pulled the plug, or, you know, my mother removed the support system with the family there. And, you know, it was just, could have said goodbye to my dad had I not gone home to take a shower. And that weighs on me, and that has weighed on me and has affected me throughout my life ever since that happened. And there's nothing like one shower wrecking your whole life. It's something, though, that if you don't discuss it, just eats away at you. And if you know, you got to tell someone. Yeah, I knew, always knew I had to tell someone. It was just, who do I want to tell? And what group of people am I willing to tell? I certainly don't want anybody in the world who knows me to know that I miss saying goodbye to my dad because I'm that arrogant and I wanted to take a shower to look good.
Ted, when you did first tell it, what kind of response did you get?
Oh, I'll be honest. I told it in a group session in a clinic I was at, and the therapists weren't qualified to handle that type of emotional outburst, a release from the people in the group. I was shaking, vibrating, and things like that. And the counselors, I don't think, were fully qualified. They weren't psychologists, but they knew they had struck something. I knew they had struck something. You know, when I got it out, it was like, okay, I feel better now. I walked out. And to me, it was like, someone's willing to listen, I don't mind. Eventually, I came to an age where it was like, look, I can't. I've had enough of letting things eat me alive. It's the way it is. I have to move on. And so from 40 on, I just stopped functioning properly. And what was the problem of this? You know, it's not because of an addiction or anything like that. It's because something's wrong with my brain. And what is it? And there's got to be something wrong. Something's happened to me that, and I've got to discover what it was. And that was certainly one of the things. So it made it hard holding a job, because you have guilt and you have constant depression because of that guilt. And depression can make you do a whole bunch of terrible things because you're depressed. Anything's better than being depressed to mask it and cover it up. But eventually all that masking and covering it up, you realize that's going to take its toll in other ways, a lot worse than just talking about it. So, anonymous shows, I will talk.
You know, it's so hard because it feels like there's so many different things tied up in it, right? There's like
guilt, yeah.
And then there's so much grief, and then just remorse, you know, for this missed opportunity. And sadness because your dad was someone you felt like you'd sort of disappointed so many times in your life, and then you were just getting that, finally, that positive feedback from him, and then it was like, oh God, like you disappointed him again. Like, ugh. I can just feel.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I did talk about pretty quickly with everybody who knew me, that, you know, my dad did enjoy me living at home just before he died, and actually said that to other people. Would never say it to his kids. You know, he would never admit that to his kids. But it was the other people around him that would always fill me in on things, you know. Oh, your father was so worried about you when you were in the hospital. Really? I didn't see him. boy, your father, you know, was, you know, real happy you've been living at home. And it was like, really? Okay, that's great. I mean, he would come home at 7 o'clock from work, and I'd spend 20 minutes talking, and that would be, but that's 20 minutes more than I'd ever would growing up. So, you know.
When you agreed to do this with me, mm-hmm. what made you decide to do this? What were you hoping for?
A forum to discuss it, a forum to get it out. I was nervous as heck. I've been walking around pacing for since, you know, my girlfriend will say, you know, She knew how nervous I was just even going to discuss it, and wanted to know what I was going to discuss, and doesn't know. No one knows what. Only knows that I was being called by an old school friend who happens to have a radio show.
Are you going to tell your girlfriend?
No. I wouldn't tell anyone. I wouldn't tell my brother. I told him about guilt about dad dying, but didn't tell him exactly what.
And how come you won't tell your girlfriend?
I don't know. That's just nothing. That type of things, I keep to myself. So
Ted, we should stop.
I hope I gave you what you wanted and didn't ramble.
No, you totally did. You totally did. If anything, what I wish is somehow that you could find more compassion for yourself, because you didn't know. You didn't know he was dying. You had no idea he was going to die. Yeah. What I feel sure of is that if you had known that this was your last half hour to be with your dad, I'm 100% sure you wouldn't have gone home to take a shower.
No. Yeah. See, that's a different perspective. I hadn't heard that one. Yep.
Yeah. So it's like, how to have so much tenderness and mercy for that young guy who didn't know.
Well, yeah. Well. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thanks, Ann.
In a way, Ted's story is all about the very reason why Safe Space Radio exists. When we hide things, we suffer more. Our next guest, Katie Murray, understands the suffering that goes along with silence. In the following interview, Katie describes her son Chan's diagnosis and battle with leukemia. She discusses the power of sharing Chan's story and the process of moving forward after such a devastating loss. Here's Katie's story. My subject today is losing a child, and my guest is Katie Murray. Katie is the mom of three boys. She and her husband together are co-directors of One World Bicycle Expedition. They lead bicycle trips through Thailand and Laos. Katie also teaches English as a second language in the Portland public school system. Katie, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're here. I want to start out asking you about talking about this, and to ask you, is it hard for you to talk about losing your son?
Well, it's funny because it's something, it's not hard for me to talk about in that I always want to talk about my son. You know, he died 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, and that's the only way I can keep him alive. I mean, one of the main ways is to be able to share and talk about him.
Mm. What's your son's name?
Chan, C-H-A-N.
Tell me a little bit about him.
Oh, Chani was amazing. He was always just really energetic and athletic, and he was very smart. And I feel like especially in the last 18 months of his life after he was diagnosed, because we gave him so much good attention, you know, he had really his whole family pulling for him, and it really seemed to bring even more out for him, to make him, I don't know, he just got better and better, it seems like.
Mm. So for you, it sounds like, even though for many people, we imagine that bringing the subject up or asking you to tell, you know, talk about Chan would make you sad or hurt you in some way. But what I hear you say is that actually you want to talk about him.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think it's sort of a falsehood or a belief in our society. People feel like when they bring up subjects like this that it makes the person sad, and for me, and I think for many people, it's not true. I mean, having your child die is so sad, and so I felt, you know, tremendous sadness for a really long time, and I still do feel that sadness, and to have someone ask me about it has always been a relief and a big part of healing. And you know, if people ask me about it and they see sadness come up, it's really just that sadness having a chance to be processed or healing happening. And it's not that they're making me sad. I mean, the sad thing happened already. You know, the sad thing was having my son get cancer and die. It's not sad to talk about it.
I think sometimes people feel they're out of respect for you. They avoid the subject, or they won't bring it up because they think that will help you
cope or function through the day or something like that.
I think quite the opposite is true. It's really being allowed to talk about it is what helps me function through the day. Uh-huh. And when people, it's always on my mind in a way. I mean, you know, I still go through my day and have my jobs and take care of my other children. But there's a part of me that's always thinking of Chani and missing him. And it's just a great gift when I get a chance to talk about him.
I'm so glad we can do that now. So maybe you can tell us the story about how you learned he was ill and kind of what followed.
Well, he'd always been really healthy and, as I say, very athletic. People are always kind of amazed at how developed he was as far as his coordination and, you know, riding a bike on his third birthday and things like that. And but then he just sort of suddenly started to go downhill. It may have been coincidental. He got a tetanus shot at when he was 4 and a half. He had fallen on a rusty nail, so he got a tetanus shot. And then within about 6 weeks of that, I just saw his health start to deteriorate. He would get colds that would linger for, you know, 2 weeks. He would get, one time he got ill with kinka sores that went on and on and on, fevers for days. And my kids said, you know, I've always been sort of hands-off in terms of letting them go through their little illnesses. And, you know, I feel like illness is a natural part of life. But it just was clear that there was something going on with his immune system. Mm-hmm. So after going to various doctors, we finally were able to find out what the problem was. And at this point, we were living in rural Thailand. And the doctor told us that we needed to move immediately back to the U.S. for treatment in Seattle, Washington, at the Hutchinson Center.
And did you do that?
We did that. Yeah, we moved in about 3 days' time. We packed up all our stuff. My son and I, my husband brought my other two boys later, a couple weeks later. And when we got there, they said this is a very rare form of leukemia. It was AML, and it was AML M6, which is extremely rare. And they said it's, you know, it's so rare we don't really have statistics to help you make decisions about chemo and things like that, but we feel like you've got to go with really serious chemo. So we did a two rounds of that, where, you know, of course he was inpatient for those rounds of chemo. They each lasted about 6 weeks. And
6 weeks inpatient the whole time.
Yeah. Oh. And I think he got about a month off between the first and second rounds.
And were you living in the hospital at the time? I mean, you didn't even
much.
Have a home in Seattle.
Yeah. Well, we were lucky that we had a community of friends there. We actually just coincidentally, again, had lived in Seattle prior to that for a couple of years. So it was nice to just be able to come home to friends, and people helped us get an apartment and get a kind of be able to function as a family. So my husband and I took turns sleeping in the hospital. And the hospital only allowed one parent to stay in the room. They wouldn't allow his brothers, which was really hard for us because the boys had always, you know, been together. And anyway, that was one thing that was very hard. But so we found an apartment near the hospital. Mm-hmm. And he actually did surprisingly well with the chemo. I mean, he still had the painful symptoms and the rashes and all the things that go along with really strong chemo. But the doctors were always very impressed at his ability to handle it, you know, and remain strong and pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the second round, and, you know, they weren't able to say, we really think he's going to pull through, but they really did seem to, you know, I think speaking to them later, they really thought that he was going to do well. Mm. And then about a month after the second round of chemo, and he really looked well. He was running around and playing, and we went cross-country skiing. And
being a kid.
Yeah. They said, well, the cancer's back. And and I skipped the bone marrow transplant. They really wanted us to have him do a bone marrow transplant. And that was a very hard decision because he seemed pretty well after the chemo, but... And as I say, again, there were no statistics to help us make these decisions, no meaningful statistics, because the number of people with AML is so small.
So even though he seemed well and that they seemed to have been, did they say he was in remission at that point, or they didn't use language like that?
I think they said a cytogenetic relapse. So he looked like he was in remission, but if with this really high-tech testing that they can do to look at the DNA, mm-hmm. they felt that there was still an issue with his DNA.
And that's why they wanted to do the bone marrow.
That's why they wanted to do the transplant. And the issue is that if they want to do it as soon after the chemo as possible, because they feel like, I guess, historically, if the longer they wait, the more cancer can build up, and then the less likely that the bone marrow transplant will be successful. So there was a lot of pressure to do it quickly.
Yes, and part of what I'm hearing is that there was a lot of uncertainty, that you were making mm-hmm. these life and death decisions for your child.
Yeah.
Without the guidance of a lot of medical knowledge to help you know what you were even choosing.
And that was really, really hard. That was really all along the way. But particularly with deciding to do the transplant, that was very hard. And, you know, they said, we know we're asking you the hardest thing you can ask parents to do. And we know you don't have enough information to make this decision, but you need to make this decision within 48 hours. You know, they really, it was challenging.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah. So how did you make it?
With difficulty. I remember he was supposed to go in on an early Monday morning for the radiation treatment. Before they can do the transplant, they actually have to go in and, as I understand it, kill your bone marrow, your own mm-hmm. bone marrow. So they do that through full body radiation. And it was, so Sunday night, I remember calling the doctor we were working with at home and saying, are you sure this is the right thing to do? And yeah, it was really hard to decide.
Radiating my boy's whole body.
That was really tough. That was a really tough
Sounds terrifying.
But the whole, I mean, the uncertainty was just hard throughout. Things like just deciding what food, you know, what was the right diet. I mean, we're reading all kinds of books and...
Right.
And of course, we tried to do all this in a less invasive way. We talked to lots of naturopaths and homeopaths, and I think they all just felt like it was such a serious disease that they didn't dare to mm-hmm. take it on. They all mm-hmm. said, you really need to get back to the children's hospital and handle it that way.
Yeah. So it sounds like you went ahead and mm-hmm. he had the transplant. Mm-hmm. Tell me more what happened after that.
And he did really well with it. Part of the procedure is to have, or the protocol afterwards is to have blood draws to check his counts every couple days. Mm-hmm. And one day the nurse called and said, well, you know, these counts are up and it could be this and it could be that, or it could be the white elephant in the room And I said, what elephant? And she said, well, it could be the cancer back. And that's what it was. So at
right
that
immediately
point,
after the transplant?
No, it was, I'm trying to remember. I guess we went back in March and the transplant was around Christmas. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. And at that point they said, he's probably got less than 2 months to live. And, you know, if you stay here, we'll support you with, morphine and transfusions, blood transfusions that he'll need. But there's really nothing else we can do. So at that point, I was ready to, you know, be a good girl and listen to the doctors and do what they said. And luckily, my husband said, no way, we're going to fight this. Uh-huh. So he's originally from Thailand. So we went back to Thailand. We took our family back. And we fought it with more natural vitamins and food and exercise and kind of more natural ways. Mm-hmm. And he was really happy to be back home in Thailand, my son. That was really great. I was so happy we could take him back.
So Thailand was home for him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he did really well. He ended up living 9 months, pretty healthy 9 months before he died. So. Mm.
So there you were with knowing that you'd been given this death sentence effectively mm-hmm. by his American doctors, mm-hmm. choosing to not give that so much power, it sounds like, and mm-hmm. to do this your own way. So what were those 9 months like for you?
They were very hard. I think I was just so terrified, you know, every day. I was just always afraid that he was going to die. I was so afraid. I mean, as all parents are, we're always afraid of losing our children, I think, and you know, whether it's deep down or whether it's up in the front of the consciousness, but
yes,
I was really afraid that he would die. And my husband was a great role model because he just felt like, well, we're not going to focus on that. You know, we're really going to just decide that he's going to live and we're going to fight this and we're not going to give up. So I had to retrain myself. I had to learn to think that way. And I feel like that, you know, I had to really do a lot of soul searching to decide that that was the right choice for Chani. You know, the best thing to do for my son was to decide that it was completely hopeful and we could live with hope and we could, you know, do all we could for him and not give up on him. Because I felt like if I had done it in the way that the doctors in the West might have, what I perceive as sort of the American, you know, way, I guess that's not really fair to say, but the other way of doing it was just be to give up and say, well, you're going to die in 2 months and we need to discuss death and, you know, we need to say goodbye and talk about it and really just give in. For me, it would have been giving in.
Mm-hmm. So you really chose differently, and does that mean did you talk about death with him? What happened in terms of actually naming it?
We did. I mean, he knew. We read a lot about cancer, and we read about, you know, well, about people who had stage four, and then they, you know, they would have died if they hadn't done this certain regimen of juice or whatever, whatever it was. So he knew that, that death was what he was up against. But we just didn't focus on it. We just felt like, why focus on something that, you know, nobody knows the future. We certainly didn't, and the doctors didn't. And there's so many stories of people who turn around. You know, they get dire predictions from their doctors, and then they actually do pull through. Mm-hmm. So we really felt like the right thing was to keep fighting for him and allow him to fight.
So it sounds like at some level, you chose hope. You made a really conscious decision. I'm guessing, did you have to keep making that decision?
Oh, every day. Sometimes every minute. It was really hard. Sometimes, you know, I'd get up in the morning and I would sort of go through a ritual of bathing in the morning, and I really had to look in the mirror and think of myself as a warrior, because it was that hard for me. And that's not sort of part of my vocabulary, you know, previous to this, but it was just so hard for me not to give in to that despair and that terror and just decide I have to be here 100% for my family and I need to fight this. And, you know, sometimes I'd cry when I was taking my shower too.
Oh, sure.
But
so what I'm sensing is that what you were really fighting in a way, I mean, you were doing all the vitamins and juices that you could, but in a way you were really fighting despair.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And very consciously taking it on. Summoning your strength like a warrior.
And I also think that I went into a bit, you know, as mothers, we know about going into crisis mode. You know, we know when our child has something, they fall down and get hurt, we're able usually to stay present and help them. And it's not till afterwards that we might fall apart. I think that can be common. And I felt like I was kind of in that fighter mode, crisis mode the whole time. You know, I felt like, well, I'm going to, you know, I know it would be really good for me to cry about this and have some feelings about it, but it's going to have to wait, you know, because I really need to just do this.
All of your strength was being focused.
Yeah,
I can imagine. And it was a long, from his diagnosis until his actual death, how long was it?
18 months.
So as he did reach the end of his life, will you tell us a little bit about how that was?
That was challenging. We had been, when we left Seattle and left the doctors there, we went to Bangkok, where we knew of some doctors with really excellent reputations who worked outside of what we call traditional medicine, who worked, as I say, with vitamins and juices and that sort of thing. And he responded really well to that treatment, but I didn't have enough faith. I thought it was a good thing and I thought it was helping him, but I didn't think it was keeping him alive, you know, per se. And one thing about Bangkok is it's a pretty toxic environment, you know, as far as pollution. And and we felt like one hope for him was to get him away from, we felt like whatever caused leukemia, because there's no way of knowing. The doctors always told us it's just totally a fluke and there's no pattern. There's no way to know what caused it. But we felt like whatever did cause it must have been some sort of toxic, something toxic in the environment that caused his body to, you know, mess up. So we felt like we wanted to remove him from any kind of toxic influences.
Yeah.
And we had a place out, way out in a really remote village in the country, up on a hilltop. Actually, it was an incredibly beautiful place. So we wanted to be there with him. So we left Bangkok, and then I think that was in October, and he died in December. So his last 2 months were there, and it was just a very intense time. I mean, every day was just, I feel like every minute was packed with just appreciation for him and appreciation for our life together and fear, you know, that was part of it. But but he was great. He we have sort of a way in our family where we work through things, which is he knew that when he was having a hard time that he knew that I could listen to him and he could process that. Like if he needed to cry or yell at me, or, you know, sometimes he'd just say things like, you have no idea how much it hurts, or, you know, these things. And he would know that I would be okay to hear all that. And it seemed like when he'd have, I guess, and we call it a tantrum maybe, but to me it was really just processing all the pain he was going through and the difficulties. He just was so clear and so present afterward that it was amazing. I felt like he just became so much wiser.
Did you see him in a lot of pain?
Yeah, he had a lot of pain. Yes, at the end. a lot of joint pain, his legs, you know, that would mm-hmm. travel, the pain would move around.
Was that one of the hardest things for you to see that?
Yeah, that was hard. I think it helped that we lived in a Buddhist country where there's a certain understanding of pain. I mean, it is pain, but there was a way that he was aware that even if there was pain in his body, his mind was still his own. Mm. So I think that kind of helped him not to be overcome by it. I remember one time offering him some morphine because we had the doctors give us morphine. And I remember offering it to him, and he said, "No, Mom, it's not really pain. It's something else. I think it'll pass if we can just sit here." You know, like he...
And he was how old? 5 then?
Yeah, he died. Yeah, he was six, a little, yeah, just 6.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I'd love to ask you about how it actually was when he died. Do you feel comfortable talking about that, or is that too much?
Well, it was definitely sad. It was really sad. But it was also beautiful. We were able to have him at home, you know, in our little cabin on the top of the mountain, and he was in bed with us. And the day before he died, I believe he must have had I don't know if it was a hemorrhage in his brain or, anyway, something happened the day before. It looked like a stroke. I could kind of mm-hmm. see him begin to lose control of his muscles. And mm-hmm. So that by the time he actually did die, about 24 hours later, 36 hours later, he wasn't able to move his body at all. And mm-hmm. we were all sleeping. It was the middle of the night. And I woke up and my husband was holding him. My husband said he woke me up.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite amazing because we believe that Chani's spirit was able to, or, you know, somehow he was able to wake his dad up,
mm-hmm.
even though he couldn't move. And
right.
We were able to be with him when he died.
Mm, so glad.
Yeah.
Katie's story is a moving example of why it's important to bring up difficult subjects. We turn now to our final guest, Lauren Conant. Dr. Conant talks about his experiences in hospice and as a professor of palliative care. He discusses things that have been most important to the patients he's worked with, including the value of hope and maintaining a sense of control.
My guest today is Dr. Lauren Conant. He is an assistant clinical professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School at the Cambridge Health Alliance. He was the medical director of Hospice of Cambridge for 11 years, trained as an internist with an interest in geriatrics, and served on the faculty of a course at Harvard Medical School called Living with Life-Threatening Illness. Welcome, Loring.
Thank you, Anne.
So glad you're here. I want to start out by asking you, what is it about the subject of death and dying that makes it so hard to talk about?
You know, it's so ironic. 24 hours ago to this moment, I was sitting on our porch in Maine on the shore of the Kennebec when visited by my wife's sister. So my sister-in-law and my wife and I were talking about the fact that their father, whom I never met because he died a year before I married Louise, developed a rather aggressive cancer and never talked about it with his children or his wife. Mm. And here we are. He died in 1963. And here we are, 40-plus years later, still feeling as though his daughters have been left out of something. And we made a specific comment about his wife that she felt really left out and alone.
Mm. So you're really speaking to the cost of how difficult it is to speak to, how much there's a legacy that comes from that for the survivors, the loved ones.
Yes, and of course, Louise's dad was of that generation where, that being in 62, 63, you had a stiff upper lip, and the noble thing to do was just tuck it in and not talk about it.
Uh-huh.
But the casualty of that is very great.
So you're speaking to one reason that makes it hard to talk about is a value on stoicism and sort of bearing it nobly, alone, and quietly.
And, you know, one must always respect the individual. We all have our sort of inventory of what makes us be who we are as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the privilege of my having been a physician for many years and going on that pilgrimage with a number of individuals who've had a life-threatening illness, and having the privilege of witnessing how they have gone through that journey. They're all individual, but there's certain generalities that the portals open up of almost a gift of being able to talk about fears, talk about sadness, talk about loss.
Mm-hmm.
Even those individuals who were the proud, uptight New England Yankee, or Yankee-esque.
So let me ask you about an example of that. So for someone for whom not talking about these things would be more comfortable, what do you think it was that made the portals open, as you say, that made it possible for that person to feel able to broach the subject?
I think they were probably given permission to be more reflective about what obviously everyone has a whole list of concerns as one is facing one's end of life.
Mm-hmm.
And if one gives one permission and space to be reflective, this is something that can't be forced, but it...
Right.
It's an invitation.
And did that invitation come from you as the doctor or from their family members generally?
I think it depends on the nature of the family.
Yeah.
And I think one of the privileges of a caregiver or a physician or indeed a member of the clergy is that the member of the clergy or a physician may be a catalyst, may be a facilitator for such important discussions to occur.
I can imagine, knowing that you worked in a hospice setting, that for a patient to be in hospice, there's some acknowledgement that their time on this earth is limited, which is already different than perhaps many people who may have a life-threatening illness but don't have something so clear that's been named. And I wonder, in your experience as a hospice doctor, did you find that it was easier to broach a subject with patients who were part of hospice than with patients, say, who weren't? Or?
Well, of course, when they make that transition from being part of a medical care program where there was an expectation and hope that whatever was being done might make a major difference, and then the acknowledgement that further surgery, further chemotherapy, further treatment would not be helpful. Matter of fact, we talk about the quality of life. It may actually interfere with one's ability to interact with one's family members or just go from day to day. That when that transition occurs, and this is so hard because some people do not want to give up, particularly younger people who have young children. There's that sense of magical hoping that, gee, if I take this next protocol, that might make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the value of that conversation or invitation of, so what do you think is going on? Or how are you dealing with all this? Or what do you think is going on? I think that is such an important question, and not only for the patient but for family members, so you can get an idea of what their expectations are, what their maybe misunderstandings are of what is happening to this particular patient.
Striking, because it's such a simple question.
Yeah, but it's so hard. Because people may be caught up in this momentum of, I think there's a certain conditioned reflex of people who read miracle stories or look at television and say, gosh, I heard that this drug or this particular program helped, and maybe it will make a big difference for me.
It strikes me, my next question about what makes it so hard to talk about is imagining that the answer to that question is really different if you're the patient or if you're the friend or family member.
Right.
And what I'm hearing you say right now is that the family member may feel that their primary job is to give hope, to find new resources, to track down an experimental medication, to keep their fighting spirit nourished and alive, and not to feel like they've given up. And I wonder if you could speak to that, if you saw that, and if that makes it really hard for people.
Well, I think that is a great observation, because they can be out of sync. You can have the patient who's just had it, just cannot bear to go through another chemotherapy or another regimen, and there's pressure on the part of the loved one of the family of wanting to make this special effort. Don't give up.
We see it in cooking, trying to feed them, trying to get them to eat, that kind of thing. Yeah.
But again, there has to be so much patience and respect through this whole process of listening and trying to get a sense of what are you most concerned about, or what are you afraid of, rather than make pronouncements about this is what I think you should do. We should. That reminds me, I think one of the big fears of individuals who are dealing with a life-threatening illness is a huge loss of control, and how one invites patient to recognize that even though indeed there is this difficulty of a life-threatening illness, that there can be elements of control, and indeed the patient and the patient's family or significant others can be partners in crafting a program which honors what the wishes are of this collective body.
And what I heard you say is that there are ways to give people back that control by honoring their wishes, and I wonder, could you give us an example of that?
Well, I think I alluded to it already, that particularly an older person may be just tired and does not want to follow the hopes and expectations of maybe the children and say, gee, Dad, why don't you just go through this? And I don't want to go through that surgery or that chemotherapy again. What I would like to do, and this falls under the category of hope and how hope gets recalibrated and when one is faced with a mortal illness, hope that maybe I can live another month or two to see my grandchild graduate from the sixth grade, or live long enough for my grandchild's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And those little landmarks can mean the world to the patient who's dying.
Mm-hmm. Hope is such an important part of the dying process. Family members and healthcare providers may tiptoe around the subject of death or not acknowledge the inevitability of death because we want to protect their hope for the future. When we do this, we may unintentionally leave our patients more alone with their fears, because no one is talking openly about what is really happening. In fact, we can embrace and facilitate a natural shift in the focus of hope as our patients get closer to death. As Dr. Conant describes, one may begin to hope for things such as seeing important life events, rather than beating the illness. In an essay in the Journal of Palliative and Supportive Care, Dr. Alessandra Strada summarizes this change. When hope for the indefinite prolongation of life no longer exists, the focus of hope can be shifted to an expectation for preserving what is meaningful in the experiencing of life.
This is the result of a temporal shift in the dimension of hope, bringing it closer and closer to this moment of experience. Here's Dr. Conant again.
You were about to tell us more about the death of your mother and how that touched you.
Well, that was quite the sort of opposite experience. Mom died almost at her 99th birthday. And she was quite diminished by a chronic illness. She didn't have cancer. She had spinal stenosis and was pretty much bedridden her last almost year of life. Very active mind. But she'd had several mini strokes. It was hard, tiny little strokes. So it was hard for her to express herself clearly. Mm. Parenthetically, for the listening audience, one wonderful way to keep a connection with your parent and a loved one who has a hard time talking is to read aloud to them. Mm. I did a lot of reading aloud. Kill a Mockingbird was a wonderful one to read aloud because we could watch the DVD. So
one can't help thinking about the beginning and end of life, bracketed, yes, or framed by that.
She read
act.
Aloud to me a lot. Hear, hear.
Yeah, that act of love and connection.
So, mother, we'd have this periodic conversation every few months, and I would acknowledge, gee, this is so difficult for you. You wanted to play your harpsichord, you want to play the piano and do needlepoint for your grandchildren, you can't. This must be so frustrating. Hmm. And this must be so depressing. Hmm. And I'd ask her about fear, and she was very clear, I'm not afraid to die. Matter of fact, I would like to die soon. Hmm. And so we would have this common conversation to say, Mom, the best we can wish for you is that you just go to sleep.
Yeah.
But promise me that night before you go to sleep, you give us a telephone call so we can say goodbye, say how much we love you, and then you can just go to sleep. Mm. And I think that was very reassuring for her to hear over many times. And indeed, towards her last week of life, she had developed, in spite of the wonderful nursing care that she received, she developed some pressure sores, which are just impossible to prevent, mm-hmm. ultimately. And she developed an infection, a lot of pain, and they were excellent about giving her morphine to keep her as comfortable as possible. And the privilege of just being at her side and just sort of quietly going through a life review, I was just sort of imaging, okay, I was in the first grade and then the second grade and progressing through sort of a life review. Sometimes I would speak it out and talk to Mother even though she couldn't respond. So that opportunity for a life review was a gift.
Mm. And so you really used the time intentionally to talk about what your relationship had meant over mm-hmm. all the years.
Yeah. Quite opposite from a chance I had with Dad.
Yeah, and do you feel like you actually said goodbye to her?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I most resonantly.
That concludes this episode of Safe Space Radio's Healthcare Education Podcast on Death and Dying. Please fill out the few quick questions on the website that will give you credit for listening and help to solidify some of the most important clinical takeaways. We'd be grateful, too, for your feedback about this show. Your responses will help us measure the impact of hearing stories from the people who know these struggles from the inside. Thank you to the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation for their support of this project, our guests, our producers Gabe Graben and Caitlin Swalje, and our education coordinator, Sarah Powers. I'm Dr. Ann Hallward, and I invite you to check out the rest of our archive devoted to telling authentic and inspiring stories about the things we would struggle with less if we could talk about them more.